Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Madera County is located in the Central Valley with Modesto to the north and Yosemite to the east. The agricultural community in the San Joaquin Valley is home to a Latino majority, where roughly one-fifth live in poverty, and access to health care is slim. That became even more challenging this month. The county's lone community hospital closed its doors, and with it, the three clinics residents relied on. And there are signs other community hospitals across the state are struggling to stay open and may suffer the same fate. Joining us are CalMatters reporters Ana Ibarra and Nicole Foy, who dove into the financial health of community hospitals across California and the consequences for residents. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
Nicole, I want to start with you. Both of you are located in the Bakersfield area, but you actually traveled out to Madera County. Paint a picture of the people that live and call Madera County home.
Well, so many of the people who live in Madera County, and particularly the ones who are really relying on this hospital, work in agriculture because it is such a sprawling agricultural area. You know, there's almond orchards everywhere. A couple of people who I spoke to live right next to those almond orchards. And it's really a community that is also kind of sometimes suffering the effects of living among all of this agriculture. Many folks who I interviewed discussed long-term chronic conditions like asthma or other breathing issues or other things that they believe come from living among a lot of pesticide exposure. But also, too, it's a community that, like you said, is Latino majority and has a lot of immigrants who are working in agriculture and also a pretty significant Oaxacan indigenous community, too. And these are all groups that are really going to be affected by the loss of this hospital.
You also are someone who grew up in the San Joaquin Valley. So that gives you, I mean, not only as a journalist, but just as a person, an intimate understanding of the needs of healthcare and the disparities that exist.
Yeah, it's. I grew up in Bakersfield, and you know, it's bigger than Madera. It's a little bit different, but there's always been this understanding that the Central Valley doesn't have quite as many resources as other parts of the state, and that was really a lot of the frustration that I think we were hearing from both elected officials and residents themselves. Just there's already kind of a really thin line of resources in places like Madera County, and that line just got much thinner.
So with all of that context, how crucial was this hospital in Madera County to the community, and not just the hospital, but the clinics?
Yeah, this hospital also had, I think, something that some people have forgotten is that this hospital also has several clinics that were in very like rural areas. Like I went out to one in Mendota with one of our photographers, and we were speaking to folks who were coming to pick up their medical records right before the clinic closed. And many of them didn't know, you know, they were trying to make plans to who their next primary care physician was going to be. They were already traveling pretty far to reach that clinic, and that clinic was already filling a really crucial need in the community. And then you also have others who are trying to, you know, map out how quickly they're going to have to get to an emergency room now, how quickly they are going to have to call an ambulance if they have something like a really serious asthma attack, and they have to wait for this ambulance to come and find them out in their little house next to an almond orchard. And these are things that I think are really going to have long range impacts, because this was also a hospital, I think, that served a lot of people who maybe didn't really go to medical care, always use a primary care physician unless they were going in for emergency care. And that has really long-lasting effects on your overall health. And now that emergency care is not available either.
Yeah, what I'm learning from you is that, you know, an already thin line of resources in the Central Valley just became even thinner.
Yes, yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah, what other options are there when, I mean, we do have good hospital systems across the state. How long would it take for someone in Madera County to travel to a hospital?
I think one of the things that, it can add, anywhere from between 20 to 30 minutes, depending on what type of care that you're going to need. There is still a chain of urgent cares, Camarina Health, that has really, from what we've been told, stepped up and expanded urgent care hours. But that's not always an option for folks who have been relying on Madera Community. And of course, there were people who were already getting their medical care in Fresno, if they had doctors that they preferred, but especially a lot of the people who were on, for example, Medi-Cal, I think something like, if I remember correctly, 60% of the hospital's norm like visits were generally Medi-Cal. That's a pretty significant loss for those folks.
And I just think about how a hospital is more than just medical care because you're part of the community. You have a unique understanding of the needs of the community, which is incredibly diverse. And there are a lot of barriers, language barriers included. What are the unforeseen or even perhaps the overlooked consequences of a hospital closure of this kind in Madera County?
I think one of the things that when we spoke to experts about this really just brought up, the impacts that we're not going to see quite yet on things like help for people with chronic conditions. Also, a hospital like this is kind of the center of a number of things, like a public health apparatus, as well as outreach and building long-lasting relationships with folks, for example, in the Oaxacan indigenous community. A number of those folks who live in the Madera area, Spanish is not their first language either. They may speak Zapotec or Mixteco, and that's something that it's really hard to replace immediately. And even the loss of it for just a few months, if the hospital does only remain closed for that long, which is a hope. That's something that's going to be very difficult to replace because those relationships didn't pop up overnight.
Anna, you also looked at this from a bigger picture and even looking at other hospitals across the state. Before we get to that, what did you learn about the root causes of Madera County's lone hospital for adults closing?
Yeah, so it seems like this has been a conversation for a very long time. Madera Community Hospital was negotiating with Trinity Health, the owner of St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno County. And so the idea was that this hospital would come in by the hospital and really keep it in the community. That deal fell through at the end of December. And they sort of pointed fingers to the attorney general. The attorney general, state attorney general, is responsible for, he oversees hospital or healthcare mergers that include a nonprofit. And Madera Community Hospital is a nonprofit hospital. So the attorney general posted conditions that Trinity Health would have to meet in order to purchase or for the state to approve the purchase of the hospital. And so, among those conditions were some price caps. And while we never got an answer from Trinity Health on what specifically, pushed them to pull out of the deal, industry people I talked to, including the California Hospital Association, explained that when you put price caps on this type of deal, it could really just make it difficult for that new buyer to pull the hospital out of the financial situation it is in.
I mean, the past few years for hospitals has been a strain financially across the state and across the country. And we're talking about smaller community nonprofit hospitals. What does this say about the state of these smaller hospitals compared to these healthcare systems?
Yeah, so the most of the hospitals we're hearing about are independent hospitals. So these have no affiliation to a larger health system, which means fewer resources. These hospitals are tend to also really serve primarily low-income populations and are heavily reliant on programs like Medi-Cal. And, for as long as I can remember, there's always been this conversation about Medi-Cal reimbursements being too low and that Medi-Cal payments to providers don't cover the cost of care. And so the argument is that these hospitals have for a long time been underfunded. And of course, then you add, you know, the pandemic to the mix. And as you know, Vicky, the hospital lobby has since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic been sort of sounding the alarm that these hospitals, especially smaller independent hospitals, are losing records amount and that we could eventually see these closures or service reductions. But for the most part, you know, federal COVID relief dollars kept hospitals afloat or at least offset some of their losses. But now that money is largely gone, and these hospitals are still having to respond to COVID waves every so often. And, you know, that includes one of their biggest expenses, which is contracted labor, like travel nurses.
Yeah, right. Because travel nurses during this time, I mean, they were getting paid, you know, compared to a full-time nurse in the same position, a lot more money per hour.
Right, right. One hospital I spoke to out in Visalia, who, you know, their CEO there has been pretty outspoken about their situation. He's expecting to have his, you know, toughest fiscal year. And, you know, he mentioned that he pays about $200 an hour for every travel nurse he has. And his contract labor rates right now are at the highest they've ever been because, you know, there's a deep labor. We've been reporting on this too, a deep labor shortage across, you know, healthcare in general.
Yeah, aside from Visalia, you've been talking with other hospitals as well that are concerned about their financial state and may be at risk of falling down that same path of potentially closing. What are you learning from them?
Yeah, I think one of the more severe cases that we're hearing about is a hospital out in San Benito County and in Hollister, Hazel Hawkins. You know, they put out or they declared financial emergency late last year, and they are now estimating to run out of cash in mid-March. And so we'll be following that because I know right now they are sort of scrambling to find solutions. You know, they did recently get a loan from the state, but I'm sure it's going to take a lot more than that $3 million loan to keep them afloat. So we'll be keeping an eye on that hospital to see, you know, what sort of solutions they can come up with in this pretty short window.
In the meantime, Anna, what is the state doing to help? What can it do?
Yeah, so, you know, I know we spoke to Senator Caballero, one of the legislators that's been pretty involved with the Madera Community Hospital and in conversations with local officials there too. You know, she did say they are, you know, trying to help sort of guide as the county in whatever they may need. You know, the state as of now, they haven't put up, from my understanding, any money as of now. I mean, it's not my understanding from what Senator Caballero told us, you know, it's not necessarily in the state's purview to reopen hospitals, but they can provide guidance and they could provide some financial help, like the loan that they provided to Hazel Hawkins. I know that the hospital association is asking for two things from the state, and one is for them to really revisit the Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, and also they are asking for a one-time $1.5 billion ask to help hospitals that are currently in danger of potentially closing. But again, we're also, you know, the state is facing a deficit right now. So I don't know what the chances of that happening are. But I know that there is a lot of conversations going on about how to help these hospitals.
Nicole, I mean, after hearing all of that, what do Madera residents do in the meantime? What are they telling you?
Madera residents, so the ones I spoke to are really, I mean, some of them are distraught. Really, they are either frantically looking for new options for their loved ones or in themselves, or they are just waiting for answers. And honestly, I think kind of frustrated, you know, with any number of people associated with this, that there aren't more answers forthcoming. And honestly, there might not be some answers for some time, but a lot of folks are, you know, hoping to try to, a lot of folks spoke to me because they wanted to spread the message that this cannot go on like this. This is going to become difficult pretty quickly. And many experts and local officials are really worried about deaths that will occur from this or from conditions that will go undiagnosed or chronic illnesses that will not get the treatment that they need. And we won't even be able to see the impacts of that for a while. But I think people in Madera County are really urgently looking for some type of assistance, whether that's the state or someone else to come and fill this really necessary resource that they need. Mm-hmm.
Finally, I want to ask the both of you this, because we don't necessarily think about healthcare until we need it in an emergency situation. What do you want people to take away from this piece of your reporting? Nicole, I'll start with you.
I mean, I think especially when it comes to healthcare in areas like the Central Valley that are often many parts of the valley are already on every list when it comes to, disadvantaged populations or under-resourced populations. And you can't wait until something dramatic like this happens to kind of build up the resilience of these areas, because there are people who frankly will suffer pretty severely when that happens and who cannot wait until an emergency catches state attention. I think some of these areas we need to turn our attention to earlier rather than waiting for an emergency.
Yeah. And when there's an actual closure. Anna, what about you?
Yeah. You know, I think thinking about this reporting in terms of California really has, I think if you ask any, you know, health policy person, they would about the achievements of California. We talk a lot about California doing a good job in expanding access to healthcare, specifically Medi-Cal for low-income populations. But we know that having, you know, Medi-Cal insurance doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the care, a timely care that you need. And so, you know, I think as we talk about the California's expansion of insurance coverage, we also need to really focus on what type of care these people or these communities are receiving. So it's just spurring a lot of ideas on what to, you know, cover and think about next.
Anna and Nicole, thank you so much for your reporting and taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Anna Ibarra and Nicole Foy are reporters for Cal Matters, sharing their reporting about Madera County's Lone Hospital closing its doors earlier this month and concern that other hospitals of its kind across the state may suffer the same fate. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. They are moms, aunts, grandmothers, and sisters with a common goal to make the city of West Sacramento a great place to live, work, and visit. This past November, voters in West Sacramento made history by electing its first ever all-female city council. According to the League of California Cities, West Sacramento is one of six communities in our state with an all-female legislative body. The West Sac Council is made up of a mayor and four council members, and they are Mayor Martha Guerrero, who ran unopposed and is now in her second term. She's also a legislative representative for the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. Council member Karina Orozco, who has served on the council since 2016 and is also an attorney and mother of four. Council member Dr. Dante Early was elected in 2021, and she is a mom and serves on the board of the United Way California Capital Region. Council member Norma Alcala was elected to the council in 2020. She was raised in West Sacramento and has five grown children and 10 grandchildren. And last but not least, council member Verna Sulpizio Hall is the newest member of the team, elected in 2022 for the first time. And we are happy to have all of the members of the West Sacramento City Council on Insight. So welcome, everyone, and thank you all for being here. It's a really good group.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's like a council member elected party here. Okay, so you all come from
there.
Yes, happy to have all of you. You all come from such diverse backgrounds, educations, professions, lived experiences, and certainly diverse perspectives, especially when it comes to politics. But is being the city's first all-female city council just a cool headline, or does it have a deeper meaning for each of you? Mayor Guerrero, I'll start with you.
Well, thank you, Vicky. I think it's a pretty significant part of our representation, representing the people of West Sacramento, but also at large, where we just celebrated, you know, and are sad about the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, where we now know that, you know, there are challenges in other parts of the nation, where California, we are protecting women's bodies and their right to choose. And for women, you know, there are other challenges where we also see the passage of SB 826, where it's been ruled as unconstitutional, where there are not enough women represented on boards, you know, in private sectors. So we are here as a women, all women city council, representing, showing that we can do an excellent job on behalf of the community.
Councilmember Orozco, what does it mean to you to be part of this history-making city council for West Sac?
Well, it is very exciting to see that when I look to the left and right, these are mothers, grandmothers, policymakers, attorneys, folks that really step up and roll their sleeves to do the work and shoulder to shoulder in collaboration with one another for the sake of a common good, our community. I have nothing but respect for the women that have decided to step forward and put their lives on the line in order to commit to that. I mean, we all do a bunch of invisible work all the time, and as mothers and people who really want to make a difference, it's just a really proud place to be.
Council member Early, you were elected in 2021. Did you think come 2023 it would be an all-female city council?
No, I had no idea that it was going to be an all-female city council. For me, the individuals I supported in running for city council, I supported them because of their values, because of the work they wanted to get done, and because I knew they represented our city. It just so happens that they were women. So it is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
Council member Alcala, you were elected in 2020. What does this mean to you? Oh, I think we lost Council Member Alcala. We'll have to get the council member back. All right. Well, last but not least, Council Member Sulpizio Hall. How about you?
I'm sorry. Can you ask that question again, please?
Of course. I mean, you were elected in 2022, just, you know, a few months ago for the first time, and now you're part of a history-making city council, all female. Is that just a headline to you, or does it have a deeper meaning?
I think there's a deeper meaning to it. You know, for a very long time, we didn't see women in places of power. You could go into any boardroom or any city council chambers and you'd see a majority of men
on the dais or around the board table. And I think over the last several years, we've seen more intentional work to support women and provide opportunities for women. And I think because of that, we have what we now have in West Sacramento of an all-female council. When I ran, we knew that there was the possibility of that, especially with my seat, because I did run against a man. As we were going through the campaign and talking to folks about their values and priorities, mentioning that there could be the possibility of the first all-female council, that got people excited because it's something that they've never seen before.
Mayor Guerrero, given that the council is all female, but it's not only West Sacramento. The Sacramento City Council is now majority female legislative body. Elk Grove's mayor is also a woman. What does this say about just women in politics and leadership positions, especially when we're thinking about the greater Sacramento region?
Well, I think it demonstrates that the constituency is looking to women to be proactive, to be engaged, to be understanding at a different level. And it demonstrates to all of us that, we are capable of doing that work because we have been doing it for a long time as mothers, and myself as a grandmother, I'm helping to raise my grandson with my daughter. So we are multitaskers. And, during the campaign, I think we were very visible and engaged with the community, so that community engagement is extremely important, is what I've seen, and important to the residents and those that we serve in our regions.
Councilmember Orozco, what do you think this signals?
When I look back, there have been days when I've been all day in trial, and I get off of work and I rush home to pick up children at the bus stop and to make dinner and then to deliver them to soccer and baseball practice. And then you arrive into closed session in order to do the work of the council for our community. I just think about all of the invisible work that women take on and how, if you remove us from the the machine, what happens thereafter? And I always say to my colleagues, if you want something done, you ask somebody busy. And as the mayor said, we are masters of multitasking, for better or for worse. But I know we are ready to get things done.
It's important to point out that these positions are part-time, right? And
absolutely,
you're juggling and wearing many, many hats, both personally and professionally. Councilmember Early, what does this signal to you? The fact that, do you think that these positions should be full-time? You all are doing so much and juggling a lot.
Well, so I am president and CEO of United Way, and we serve the 5-county region. And so when I think about the intense amount of juggling that we do undertake, it is a lot. We are really fortunate to have a really strong, committed city staff. And so we could not do this work without that support, because so much of the work really does rely on us making those high-level decisions and then our staff executing. It goes beyond just our city council meetings. And I think that's sometimes what people don't understand. In addition to our city council meetings, which are every other week, we also have another 5 boards and councils that we sit on to represent our city, both at the county and regional level. And so, yes, I do think it is more of a full-time job. But I also think we are really fortunate to have these committed women who are stepping up despite having children, despite having very demanding jobs, because they're so committed to our city.
Councilmember Sulpicio Hall, given that this is your first year as a council member and West Sacramento has grown so much in recent years, what are some of the top issues that you want to tackle?
For me on my campaign, connecting with residents in my district, it was really about increasing the quality of life for those that we serve. And my priorities included expanding access to affordable childcare options and mental health. And one thing that we've heard citywide, and we know it's a priority, is prioritizing road repair and ongoing maintenance. And it's very, a lot of the policies that women bring to the table, we bring our gender affects our policy priorities. And you kind of see that in the things that I brought to the table. But our city council is focused on increasing the quality of life of the residents we serve. And so, like I mentioned, road maintenance, we've got millions coming to improve some of our park spaces in the city and some redevelopment of some really unique spaces, including the Pheasant Club here in town.
Right. Yep. The Club Pheasant, which actually it's historic and unfortunately closed. So that chapter has come to an end. But making way for a new chapter for the city of West Sacramento, which all of you are going to decide upon as elected officials. Council Member Early, what issues do you want to tackle for this year in 2023?
As someone who has a background in behavioral health, I think that you can't go very far without seeing the significant housing shortage and needs of our neighbors who are unhoused. I have actually ran the past 3 years, and so I've had the privilege of knocking on doors since 2020 every single year. And I've heard from neighbors how this is something that has increasingly become front of mind. And so I think it's important that we work on transitional housing in order to support our neighbors who are unhoused and potentially have mental health needs, and affordable housing. As COVID has happened and folks have migrated from high income jobs in the Bay Area to Sacramento, we've seen that there is no longer real, true, affordable housing. And so those are some of the issues that I'm hoping to tackle with my colleagues, but also in partnership with our county colleagues, as well as regional.
Councilmember Orozco, where do you think you can make the biggest difference in West Sacramento?
I think every day we have an individual choice to look at our community with a different lens. And in the last 6-7 years that I've been serving on the council, I've seen tremendous changes. I look forward to working with my colleagues to bring our brains together in order to tackle those very, very important issues. And excuse me, a lot of the issues that we've voiced are very common to a lot of the residents in our city. And I think that we're working hard to make sure we reflect that in our decisions. Mm-hmm.
Mayor Guerrero, given that you are now reelected, you have seen the issues grow and evolve in the city of West Sacramento. What is your priority for this year?
Well, thank you. That's a very good question. I share the priorities that my council members just voiced at this time. I think in strengthening our partnership in working with the president's administration, our state and the governor's administration, our county partners in drawing down funding, both federal, state, and local funding, to make sure that we can make these priorities, come to fruition, which to ensure that we have the sufficient funding for infrastructure, which we are hearing from our residents, potholes is a big issue, but also seeing that the recent atmospheric river hitting our city very hard, making sure that we have flood protection and continue to shore up, our levees, which we're very grateful for Congresswoman Matsui and the president for making sure that we have received the federal funding necessary for that, and making sure that we also have the resources to provide a response for our first responders who are in the front lines, and both our firefighters and our police officers, because I think they're stretched really thin as our city is growing. So ensuring that, and affordable housing is another priority, which we've been doing, I think, well in the last couple of years, where we've significantly have seen, as you've seen on the riverfront, the number of housing that has been built, both at the market rate, but also the affordable housing with our new Tower Gateway, and supportive housing with our Mercy Housing on West Capitol Avenue, and Project Home Key, which we've established a strong relationship with the state and county level. So making sure that if we have all different levels of housing available, as Councilmember Early stated, I'm really grateful that we have such a good council that is willing to address and prioritize all these issues.
Yeah, the riverfront has just completely been transformed in recent years. And there's been a lot of really cool and new attractions in West Sacramento. So let's end on an exciting note, from the Van Gogh Experience to Enchant Sacramento over the holiday, Cirque du Soleil. I mean, these are all pretty big deals for the city. What excites you about West Sacramento? And maybe if you can give us a little preview of what maybe the city has up its sleeve for 2023. Mayor, I'll start with you.
Well, we are real excited for our mobile farmers market that's continuing on, and our, you know, Van Gogh that we're going to continue to see the exhibit grow and maybe evolve into something unique and different. We're continuing to work with the producers of that. And also, we have a new owner of our Rivercats. So, you know, strengthening that partnership and seeing the possibilities and what they envision for our riverfront. So that's been really exciting and new. And working with an all-female city council member.
Council member Orozco, what excites you about West Sac this year?
Well, West Sacramento, West Sacramento has always been known as the tiny little city that can. You know, we have transcended so many expectations from being this, you know, small working class city that's been couched in between much more major metropolitan area cities. And, you know, I do want to continue the vision that was set long before we ever became council members, which is to, you know, bring that vibrancy and continue that momentum. We do have a thriving riverfront, and there's so much more to come. We also have a thriving business community we look forward to supporting post-COVID. But in addition, you know, there are families that are relocating to our city because they recognize that it's a gem in the region and they want to raise their families in a safe community with beautiful parks. And to be a part of that vision is very exciting to me.
I've heard of the hashtag West Sac Best Sac.
It is. Yes, it is.
Well, Councilmember Orozco, I also want to bring up something that you did reveal publicly about some serious health challenges. And I just want you to give you an opportunity to share just as much as you feel comfortable and also your message to your constituents and the community that have wrapped their arms around you and supported you.
Well, thank you. I don't want to take any of the emphasis away from the dynamic women that are on this council that stand by, you know, by my side. But I will say that I have received a tremendous amount of support from not only my colleagues, but yes, the community as well. And I mean, when it comes to the point where you you know, you're compromised in some way, you definitely have to lean on the folks who can provide that support. And I've seen nothing but that from the leaders at my side, as collaborative in our leadership abilities and as mothers and as people who are naturally caregivers. And that's not to generalize, but, you know, that's how women have been viewed. But I think that they have definitely embraced this journey. And together, as we navigate the path, we are also leaving a trail behind us for others to step forward in such a fashion.
Yeah, that's wonderful and incredibly powerful. Council Member Early, what excites you about this year and what makes, you know, West Sac Best Sac?
Well, I will often use that hashtag. I don't want to leave, though, that what my colleague just said. As really busy women, oftentimes we put ourselves last because we are taking care of everyone and everything around us. And I think that's even more magnified when you are a public servant. And I, as we talked about, this is mostly an unpaid position. This truly is the purest form of public servant. And we put our community first before ourselves as well sometimes. And so when my colleague shared that her diagnosis and what had happened, I immediately got fully checked up. And I know so many other women immediately made the time. And that is the important part, that women need to make the time to take care of themselves first and put their safety mask on first before helping others, because you can't help others and pour from an empty cup. So I didn't want to leave that part. So what excites me? In addition to being all women, we are also all women who are people of color. And so you have seen probably even more infusion of culturally exciting and relevant activities and opportunities for our city as well. And one of which was The Color of Music, which was an all African-American or African Black American orchestra that played music that was composed by Black composers who often in our history did not get the platform here in the US. And so we will be bringing them back next year. And we're really excited for that regional partnership and those kinds of opportunities in which we're not only, as Councilmember Spiegel Hall voice, bringing our gender, but we're also bringing our culture to the table. And that part really excites me as well.
That's wonderful. Councilmember Spiegel Hall, I will leave the last message to you.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. So I'm a mom of a 2-year-old, and I actually have a 5-week-old as well. And where we love to spend our time is our local parks. And we have had such amazing opportunities to meet other families. And post-COVID, people in our community are really desperate for connection and having space to do that. And so I'm excited about, you know, we mentioned the Pheasant Club reuse, creating a community space there that we can gather and hopefully, you know, feed our bodies with fuel. And then our local parks, you know, Heritage Oaks Parks in my district has got millions of dollars coming to it. And this is work from our current council and for years before to create spaces that we can bring families together. So I'm really excited for those spaces to be expanded and for us to be able to step in and program and to bring the community together.
Well, to the mayor and all the city council members, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very, very busy schedules.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is the mayor and city council members of West Sacramento. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We just interviewed the women who make up West Sacramento's first all-female city council. Certainly a proud milestone for West Sacramento and the community, but also for women in our area seeking to get involved politically. On Thursday, the Sacramento County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls will be holding a reception to honor many of our local elected women and learn about several nonprofits that support women and girls in our area. It turns out that Sacramento County is one of the largest counties in California that did not have a commission of this kind until very recently. In fact, it's only been up and running for just over a year. Erin Saberi is the chair of the Sacramento County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls and joins us now ahead of the event on Thursday. Good morning, Erin.
Good morning.
So this may be an introduction to a lot of people listening. What is the mission of this commission?
Well,
I didn't make that actually rhymed. Sorry, keep going.
The mission of the commission. Yes, well, the mission of the commission is really to uplift women and girls and in Sacramento County and our region, to advise the County Board of Supervisors and the public on issues relating to the well-being of women and girls. And we have been asking the question in the run-up to forming this commission, how are the women and girls of Sacramento County? And the ultimate mission is to answer that question and to be responsive and to help policies, programs, and information be spread and shared for supporting women and girls.
And although this is, you know, recently new for Sacramento County, I mean, this commission does exist elsewhere. How long does the Commission on the Status of Women and Girls, how long does it go back in the state?
Well, it's really been over 50 years since women's commissions have been formed, starting back in the Kennedy administration with Eleanor Roosevelt, and then internationally. Women's commissions are robust and dynamic throughout the world. And also here in California, we have a state women's commission and 28 throughout the state of California.
How did this commission in Sacramento County come about? Who started it and why?
Well, it was myself and a group of really dynamic women who, interestingly enough, we didn't know each other, but we, out of the out of the women's, you know, the Me Too movement, the women's marches, and this kind of, again, exploring a sense of women and women's issues that evolved about 5 or 6 years ago, we kind of looked around and asked the question, you know, how do we build a sustainable accountability to answering the question of how are the women and girls? And we realized that Sacramento was one of 2 of the 8 largest counties in California without a commission. And we thought, well, this is perfect. We need to go deeper in instead of just marching and asking for support for women and girls, we need to have that institutionalized on a county level.
Given that this has been in existence for a little over a year, what are you learning?
We're learning that well, over a year, but in our run-up to the commission, we had also a Blue Ribbon Commission that examined and all the women's commissions and made a report to the board as to why a women's commission would be important and useful. And in that, we did a lot of deep listening. We looked at answering that question of how are the women and girls, and we found that there wasn't much data to answer that question, so we began listening. And in listening to women, we learned a lot of things. We learned a lot of what the needs are, and we also learned that the power of coming together and sharing and uplifting one another. And also, of course, during the COVID crisis, we've learned a lot about how the inequalities prior to the crisis got exacerbated.
What are the specific needs of women in our area, especially when you're touching upon that many of these issues were exposed in recent years because of the pandemic?
Yeah. And, you know, in many ways, women, there's been international studies, national studies about the disproportionate impact of the crisis on women, and particularly in women of color as well, and in neighborhoods and areas where communities were already not doing well. But for women across the board and of all economic stature, we're seeing an incredible stress. We're seeing issues from childcare to domestic violence, issues that are new and weren't there before and are coming. And we're also seeing this workforce issues. You know, many of the dominantly led by women workers, those are under stress, whether it's from teachers to nurses to caregivers. And we're finding that before COVID, while 46% of women were holding jobs, over 54 to 55% of the job losses are from women. So disproportionate job losses as well. And also it goes, you know, we have a very robust women-owned businesses here in the Sacramento area. And like all businesses, small businesses, they're under stress as well.
Yeah, of course. And we've had those conversations, which are incredibly important, at length here on Insight. When you're doing these listening sessions, you're learning about these really serious issues that need to be addressed in our community. Who do you take them to get some actionable change?
Well, we're going to be taking them to the Board of Supervisors. And as you said, we're just new and we've got a work plan that we're building for our commission. And we invite women in throughout the region to join us. We're going to take them to the Board of Supervisors, to the public, but also women, to help women. I think that we have a great tradition here of volunteerism and support, community support. We have an extraordinary organizations supporting women and girls, and we've been working with the leaders of those organizations, and who, by the way, are also under stress. The organizations are under stress from COVID. We're going to be working together to build those bridges of support.
And this week, in about 2 days, on Thursday, you're going to have an event. Who's invited and being honored, and what will people learn by attending?
Yes, well, we're celebrating the newly elected women leaders in our region. And as you just had West Sacramento, which is not in our county, but it's part of our region. And we're very proud that women leaders are coming into their own. And we have now for the first time more women on the City Council of Sacramento. And so we're going to be celebrating these women, 14 newly elected women leaders in the region, and the many women leaders serving in higher levels of leadership who've been reelected, our County Board of Supervisors, the Congress, the State Senate and Assembly. You know, we have women mayors in 4 of our 7 cities, and that doesn't count West Sac. So we've got women's leadership, 23 city council members, leaders of school boards, and districts and the president and vice president of SMUD. So all of them will be coming together with also organizations serving women and girls so that we can share information about the resources available, bring the women leaders together. And we really think that women leaders coming together across party lines, across the region, and also all these organizations serving women and girls in different capacities, that we can really make a difference together.
Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Erin Saberi is the chair of the Sacramento County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls, and we do have more information about the event on Thursday on our Insight page. And with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minada. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.